So one of the hardest parts of tshuva is trying to travel to a darker place than we normally like to live in. We like to live with healthy self-esteem. We like to feel proud of ourselves, as we should. Not egocentric, not arrogant, not cocky, but healthy image. People that don't have a healthy image of their lives get into some very, very unhealthy relationships. Unfortunately, we live in a world of a lot of emotional, interpersonal abuse. And typically, not always, but typically, a person with low self-esteem find themselves on either side of those very, very unhealthy relationships, and sometimes both. Very often abusers don't have self-esteem. They've got to try to win it from people through very, very violent and invasive fashion. And of course, if you're a victim of it, it's because you don't have the self-esteem to say, I don't deserve this treatment. And, public service announcement, Mirat Hashem, we're going to have a Yom Iyun at some point of the year dedicated to mental health and halacha and all the areas that Baruch Hashem, our society, is much more aware of. And if you ever know someone who is in those types of relationships and you can help them, or Chas Hashem, you're in a relationship on either end, it's absolutely, absolutely crucial. People's lives are wrecked by unhealthy relationships at all levels, siblings and spouses and parents and children. And it's very, very important. And of course, friends, employers. But during the month of Elul, we want to go to darker places in our neshama. And you all were raised, Stephen, please take a booklet. We were all raised on the very, very easy, formulaic, three-part structure of tshuva. Vidui, charata, kabbalah lasid. Charata, vidui, kabbalah lasid. And unfortunately, it's a trap. Because, please, thanks, Shmuel, you'll be the monitor. Because charata sounds like regret, and in the modern parlance, regret is a very relaxed moral inventory. These are the mistakes I made. I should have done better. I pledge improvement. I can't let myself feel too low about them. I did my best. Everyone's human. Everyone fails. And that's a human scale for tshuva. It's very relaxed and relative and accepting your humanity. Of course, you have to accept your humanity. But there's a certain darkness and a night of the soul that David HaMelech senses in Tuprakim and that many other Nevi'im sensed. And their tshuva wasn't limited to very cool and collected charata. When the Rambam describes Hilchos Tshuva, Perek Aleph, Halacha Aleph, source number one, Aleph, he writes, An Hashem, his Lashon Avidoi, as a fourth element. And this is really, to me, one of the greatest, if not the greatest challenge of tshuva. An Hashem, Chatasi Avisi, Pashati Lefanecha, Vasisi Kach Vekach, Varei Nichamti Uboshti. I'm not just regretting it. I don't just resent it. Nechama, Charata. I'm just ashamed. I'm embarrassed. Now, part of the challenge of feeling embarrassment is, number one, as I said before, because we like and we have to create a emotional stasis and stability and equilibrium. And embarrassment is when that equilibrium becomes destabilized. When all of a sudden you don't feel so healthy about yourself, you feel exposed, you feel vulnerable, you feel like you don't want people looking at you at that moment. Part of it is, I don't know that many of us really know what shame is. We don't really live in a world of shame. We live in a world of very loud, aggressive, cockiness, shaming other people, not really. We don't live in a world of dignity and honor. Certainly some of the political discourse and the socio-cultural discourse in our world is very shameless. People aren't holding themselves to a higher standard. What will people think about me if I say that? If anything, it's exploited. The more shame, there's no such thing as bad PR. The more shame and the more discomfort I feel, the better it is for whatever silly, timeless, transient agenda person adopts. But the Nevi'im were very aware of shame. When Ezra returns in a very, very dark period of Jewish history, it's actually a bittersweet period. It's very exciting because they're coming back to Eretz Yisrael, but it's a very, very stunted return. The first wave returns with Zerubbabel. And not as successful. Second wave comes back with Ezra and Nehemiah, a little more successful. But only 42,000 Jews returned. A very, very limited return. Because I'll say that if everyone would have returned, I wouldn't say we wouldn't be here now. We would have been here now before Yerzman began. There wouldn't have been a long gullus. That would have been the ultimate geula. But unfortunately, people were too comfortable in Bavel. But it wasn't just the paltry numbers who returned. But most of the people who returned were the riffraff, the mamzerim, the shetukim, the nesinim, the halalim. The more pedigreed people were more established in Babel. They had affluence, they had influence, they were positions of prestige. They didn't want to give up their townhouses, so come back and live in the desert of Israel. And even those who did return, they all returned with their baggage. And I don't mean they returned with their suitcases, they returned with their Persian wives. Persian women had some trance, they were very enchanting. And they all returned with Nashim Nachriyos. And it's an admixture of a lot of conflicting emotions. And Ezra feels the pain, not just of his own experience. It's so important in Yom Kippur to stretch your experience to a collective experience. And I hope just standing in the base matters, seeing soldiers walk in, just feeling that sense that it's now no longer just you and your shul and your needs, but now you're part of a larger collective, organic entity called Am Yisrael. Again, just to make it more personal, I'm sure there are hundreds and thousands of other soldiers. When we were enjoying our Rosh Hashanah, my son was out. He told me stories. And unfortunately, they shot a mechabel, so he had to watch the body for a couple of hours. He was there on guard duty. And another infiltrator from Gaza came in. He wanted to have asylum. So my son was in charge of just watching him. He wanted asylum, and my son was trying to talk to him and make small talk in English and Arabic, whatever. And unfortunately, they returned this asylum seeker across the boundary, across the border to Gaza. Evidently, the Israeli soldiers saw that as soon as he got back, the Hamas people came and shot him right in front of their eyes. It's very sad for the people that were trying to help this evidently asylum seeker. I don't know why his asylum wasn't granted, but if he can grant under the rules, but it's hard to realize that for every boy that's in the base medrash on Yom Kippur davening, there have to be other people guarding the fences and maintaining our security. So Ezra feels it very deeply, and he says, Amart va'amrai said, Elokai, the last pasuk, which after the whole description of Lo nivdalu ha'am Yisrael va'konim va'alviyim me'amer atzels, they didn't separate from their wives, and they came back with all these foreign women. Elokai boshti, I'm just embarrassed. Nechlamti, I feel shame. Larim elohai panay lecha, I can't even raise my head. I'm embarrassed to raise my head. Have you ever felt that way? Probably in cases where you did something really stupid or foolish, or you fell, or you slipped, or... But probably rarely when your conduct just didn't live up to your expectations. Like, yeah, I don't want to face people. Because they're on top of my head. They're hovering. Wherever I walk, I feel like they're chasing me. Of course, Daniel feels it several years earlier. We voice Daniel every day before we begin our slichos, l'chash, and matztaka. I'm embarrassed that we frittered or squandered the opportunity of the mikdash. David HaMelech is very aware of it in Tehillim. And I keep urging you, when you get a chance, these are the two or three prakim that will really help your Yom Kippur. Lamed Ches, Nun Aleph, lesser known, and of course, Shirem Alas Mimei Makim, which we say every day in davening. I'll speak about Shirem Alas Mimei Makim a little bit tomorrow after davening, just to give you a structure of what the parak is based on. Mizmor LaDavid LaHaskir, this is Lamed Ches. Hashem, Al Bekitz Becha, Tochichenu, V'chamascha Tiasreini, don't be angry with me, he feels Hashem's anger. Towards the bottom of the page, source vav, I feel your arrows are piercing me. Imagine when you feel like Kodesh Baruch, sometimes you feel people are looking at you, piercing arrows. You feel like Kodesh Baruch who's shooting arrows at you. Ein misom bibsari bibnei zamecha. Your anger causes me disquiet. I'm restless. My bones are shaking. Ein shalom batzamai bibnei chatasi ki'avonasi evru roshi ki'masa kaved. Like Ezra would say, hundreds of years later, David feels the weight of his sins over his head. Hevishu namaku chaburasai. My wounds are now pus and they're infected. Hevishu namaku is pus and infection and contagion. Na'avesi shachosi ad me'od. I feel very, very low and sad. To me, these four words, it's words that really catch me. Kol hayom koder hilachti. My whole day, I feel like I'm shrouded in darkness. I'm walking around, it's shining outside. The birds are chirping. People are strolling across the boulevard, sipping their ice cream. We feel that when people suffer a loss and you're out of sync with the rest of the world, everyone's going about their day and you're just in a different place and you're just enmeshed in sadness. Kol hayom koder hilachti. Ki ksalai malu nikla, my innards are feel it. Ein misom bivsari nifugosi v'nit kesi ad meod. This is depression, dikaon, nit kesi. Sha'agasi, sha'akti minam aslibi. I'm screaming from the inner part of my heart. Next page, Pasuk Yud Aleph. Libi scharchar azavani koach. My heart is dizzy. I don't have any strength. I'm walking around dizzy. V'arhenai gam heim ein iti. I can't look out of my eyes. My eyes aren't radiant or resplendent. Ohavai v're'ai minegid nigi. People are looking at me and they just are walking away. Obviously, they're not walking away. This is a projection. But I feel like people don't want anything to do with me. V'kurvai mirachok amodu. And my friends are keeping their distance. Feel free to say honestly to yourself that you never felt this. Could be that at this stage of your life you don't feel it. To be honest, I feel it a lot. Less now, but when I was going through development and I acted in ways that I felt were inappropriate with who I wanted to be and my self-identity, I felt really embarrassed to come to the base matters. I felt like I was walking in this tunnel of darkness and people around me. I see people in the street happy, normal, going about their daily routine. I felt like if they only knew my secrets, they only knew my failures, they only knew my shortcomings, they wouldn't look at me that way. They'd want to keep their distance. They wouldn't want to relate to me. They wouldn't want to talk to me. And this is how the Rambam tries to place us into a different stage. It's really hard. I think the Yetzirah for the next week, you know what he really wants from you? What he really wants you is to do tshuva for the following three or four chatayim. If he gets you to do tshuva and to obsess about these three chatayim, then he's got you where he wants. Because he knows he can't blunt your tshuva. I mean, you're all serious boys. You're not here for fun and games. You're here for tshuva. You're hoping the next week to really engage in this process. So he can't oppose it. He's not going to encourage you to watch movies Yom Kippur night. It's not going to work or to read books. You're going to be engaged. You're going to be locked and loaded. So what he'd like you to do is he'd like to divert you. So you know what you have to do tshuva for? Kibud av va'im. Who doesn't? Lashon hara. Who doesn't? Bittul Torah. Great. Kavan and Tfilah. Wonderful. These are the generic tshuvos that we just fall into. We spend all of our time thinking about. We never really get down to the bone. We never really strip away the flesh. Like imagine you had a prisoner of war. Not that I have prisoners of war in my life. You have a prisoner of war. You have to feed him something. Right? He can't die. So you throw him some cold fish like in Vietnam. Throw some cold fish down to the hatch. Feed him something. So the Yetzer Hara knows he has to feed you something over the next week. So he feeds you some cold fish. And Lashon Hara, he's really, really happy if you spend your entire week thinking, oh, I got to spend less time Lashon Hara, more time learning, better key, whatever aim. Come on, that's not you. That's not the dark places of who you are. That's not discovery. That's not revelation. That's just skimming the surface like everyone else. Let's go on a hoverboard and go in the ocean and skim the surface without really getting into the depths of the sea to study the marine life. And it's so hard to pierce that outer shell of tshuva because we delude ourselves that we're doing tshuva. Think of it this way. I don't know anyone else's experience. I only know my own. When I start Al-Khayt, when Yom Kippur begins, I'm probably batting about 30%, 300. Namely, 3 out of 10 I'm able to trace to myself. The other 7, I'm still in denial. What does that really mean? With this and with that? That's not me. I have a hard time because I'm still stuck in my prison of ego and delusion. And I'm still, that's not really me. Then as I wear down, as I get a little bit further away from food and drink and pettiness, and we'll talk about this a little bit later, then all of a sudden, it starts rising. Start to get about 90%. But I'm not a loan shark, so neshech v'marbis, I don't have too many, but I try to think of when I do ribis the dibur and avak ribis, but I can't say that I bat 1,000 and every single halchet resonates with me, but most of them start to resonate. I'll send out on the WhatsApp if you want an electronic version of the halchet that a Talmud prepared. You can already start to read the halchets. How do you go to that place? How do you go to a place you never really feel? And it's important not to feel. You can't live your life in shame and embarrassment. And how do you make a difference between frustration and shame and mortification and instability and darkness and sadness and melancholy, all those emotions I wish on everyone here. It's far beyond regret. It's far beyond formulaic tshuvas. And how do you stop that from bleeding into despair and hopelessness and surrender? That to me is really the boundary of tshuva. If you don't get too close to the cliff, you're not staring into the abyss. Chas v'shalom, you fall over the cliff, then it's a long way down. You go into a into death spiral. How do you face the two? How do you get into that mood? You can read David, read Tehillim, you can read Ezra, read Nehemiah. But, these are books of Tanakh, and the phraseology is very general and vague. But there's a beautiful story that Rav Amital would read for us every year. which is not modern, but a little bit more elaborate, a little bit closer to home. We can put ourselves into that person's shoes, feel what he feels, cry as he cried, then maybe try to find that common denominator, that common frequency. It's the story of Elazar ben Dordaya. It's cited by the Gemara of Avodah Zarah, source number Dalet. And again, guys, please, if you're exhausted, feel free to put your head down for a few minutes and wake up again. I know it's exhausting, the end of the time, it's Baruch Hashem, you're all here, Kol HaKavod, but don't be embarrassed if you're a human being, right? Superman died a long time ago. So, Elazar ben Dordaya. Amru Alavar, Elazar ben Dordaya. Source number Dalet, Shalohi Niach. Zona achas ba'olam shelo ba'ala. Can you imagine? He covered every single zona. There wasn't a prostitute alive that he hadn't engaged with. And at some point, as we know, the more you feed your desires, the hungrier you get, because the standard rises. The stimulus is something in psychology. I'm not familiar with it. But the bar of stimulation rises, and yesterday what was stimulating is no longer stimulating, and becomes old challah and old news, and it's so familiar to you, and there's a certain appeal to the untried and the unexperienced and the exotic and the distant. And so many times people, not often, I'm not at that stage, but when I'm not functioning in yeshiva, obviously in yeshiva there's more of a controlled environment, but I'm not functioning in yeshiva, people go, what's wrong with taking marijuana, something for non-medical purposes? Hasn't really been scientifically been proven to be. And a lot of things to discuss, and it's really not for the context of this year, but I'll write a lachas because it's a gateway. Because by engaging in that world of dependency and subjecting yourself to chemical dependency, at a certain point it loses its bang and you're no longer excited by it, and you're looking for the next and always looking for the next. And it's a very, very slippery slope, and it's a classic gateway. And in many, many ways, so many of our behavioral habits are gateways. Well, this per se may not be that terrible, but it serves as a gateway. And as you know, one thing leads to another, especially in a world of seamlessness and connectivity. It's very easy to fall down that slope, or to use the other metaphor, to enter that gateway. So it's an incredible, incredible profile of someone that left no stone unturned, no zona unvisited. But Pam Achas Shama, he heard about the prostitute that he hadn't visited. The prostitute that lived far, as I said before. Something catches our minds. We always feel envious or desirous of that which we don't have, things that are beyond us. It's so important to live with a sense of contentment with your own space and your own reality and your own four amos and what you can control. Sometimes we're always looking, again, these cliches, I don't want to turn this into a series of cliches, but the grass is always greener, not just by your neighbor's grass and your neighbor's money. But somehow these things that are unfamiliar to us exert a hypnotic spell on us that in our surroundings don't. We always assume it's a travel bug. You assume that if you get on a plane and travel to some exotic country, it's going to have more in store than your current location. Then you get there and it's pretty banal. It's pretty unexciting. It's people just going about their lives, making dinner, shopping in the Makola. Obviously, it's nice to travel, get some exposure, meet people, but people are constantly itching for travel and to look in other places and to more or less what HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I wish on all your lives, maybe not in the next couple of years, but as quickly as possible, that your lives become very, very, very boring, very, very, very quickly. At that point, you know you're engaged in a world of meaning. Because to create meaning, you have to repeat your steps again and again. You have to be in one location with one group of people and breed them and feed them and steer them and really infuse them with values. And I mean, even now you're starting to feel as some of the bells and whistles of yeshiva are fading. Obviously, there are big bells and whistles over this week, but you're getting a taste of that. The real accomplishment is the day-to-day routine that's repetitive, it's boring, it's consistent and continuous. And there's nothing really unique about that zona, but he felt drawn. Haisa notalis kisti narim bischara. And he also heard that she demanded a sack of gold. Well, if she's demanding a sack of gold and everyone's willing to pay it, then she must be something special, or Elazar ben Dordaya reasons. How often do we subject ourselves to groupthink? How often in this supposed world of democracy and free thinking, do we abdicate our free thinking just because everyone's doing it? How often does the culture convince us that if everyone's watching a particular event or a sporting event, then we have to see it, or a movie, then we have to see it, or we have to be the first, or a new phone, or we have to buy it because of all the hype, or the most undemocratic. It's so ironic that the internet, which is in many ways a democratizing force, provides so many traps of democracy. How often do you choose a video to watch based on how many people have watched that video? A viral video, I must see it, right? It's just on the news feed, everyone's watching whatever, then it must be important enough for me to watch. You've abdicated any judgment, any sense of whether I want to watch it or not, or whether it's something I'd like to see or not, because if everyone's looking at it, then it must be something very exciting. Millions of people have watched it. So if everyone's paying money, then, right, the mistake, if everyone's paying money for that athlete, he must be a good athlete. Maybe not. Maybe just everyone's paying money for it. So it was not just the distance that enchanted him, but the fact that everyone's giving her money. She must have something that the others don't. Natal Kisti Narim, line number 3. V'halach, very sad. V'halach v'avar aleha shiva naharas. Can you imagine being so stupefied? Every once in a while we get lost in ourselves. Every once in a while, you'll say, Mirtz Hashem, Anyam Kippur Chatasi Avisi Pashati. Chatasi means sins of neglect. You didn't know the halacha. You didn't know it was asur. Avonos are sins of lust. Those are obvious. Pashati, sins of rebellion. I don't see any rebels in this room. I don't see any Spinozas. I don't see any agnostics. I don't see people eating ham sandwiches in your kippur just to show you're off the derech. You're all, Baruch Hashem, nice, firm boys. What do you think about when you say Pashati? Are you really such a rebel? The fact that you have doubts doesn't make you a rebel. Everyone has doubts. Judaism's living with doubts. We'll never know. It's summoning the inner faith and the fortitude and the connectivity to people and your masara to live with that, to say that's a leap of faith. Never one day you'll walk down the aisle. You're not going to know on paper whether this woman will make a good wife and have a good family or not. The greatest decisions in life are the leaps of faith. And you'll have to learn how to make those. And people that can't make those decisions are forever crippled. Whether it's deciding where to live in a brave way or to do something brave. Very often the security blankets provide mediocrity. And the great leaps of faith hurdle us towards greatness, towards real accomplishment. By definition, because to be great, you have to leave your comfort zone. You have to go somewhere else. You have to depart your reality. You have to try to reach for something beyond your natural grasp. And that takes a lot of courage. But you have to make that leap of faith that I've got the talent and I've got the resources and I've got good people to help me and I'm going to just go for it and I'll do it. And marriage is a leap of faith. And Baruch Hashem, you're getting your people here in yeshiva. You're not going to prove HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You're not going to prove Har Sinai. At a certain point, you meet people here. We met people, and they met people, and they met people, told them I'm the Sar from Har Sinai, and you make that leap of faith, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When you say Pashati, you don't think about your brave acts of theological rebellion. We all go through our momentary rebellions. When's the last time you needed Hashem to take time out? You said, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I need to do this right now. At some point, I know it's wrong, whether terribly wrong or just subtly wrong, but I just need you to walk away for a few minutes, Hashem. I need to put you out of my mind. If I think about you here in the room, it's just not going to happen. I need you not to be in the room. The beautiful Medrash that when Potiphar's wife is chasing Yosef, I think there was a picture of her god on the wall or something, and she throws a blanket on it to cover it up. Or I forget what the exact Medrash is, but if you always felt Hashem's presence in the room, you probably wouldn't behave that way. Remember, Rav Lichtenstein would tell us, if you find yourself morally weak, imagine someone that you really admire being in the room. And all of a sudden, you'll live up to standards you weren't otherwise capable of. When Rav Aaron's in the room, I felt like I had to live by a certain code. I had to be better than I would otherwise be. When I feel like Kodesh Baruch Hu's in the room, I feel like I have to live up to certain standards and be a little bit more noble and more moral. And how often do we just block Hashem out? We create this momentary dissonance, this momentary lapse. Hashem Kodesh Baruch Hu, I'm here for you, you're here for me. I just need to do this, and I'll make believe you're not here for me. That's a pshia. That's the avon is we just fall into this quick lust and need. But the pshia is when you elongate and say, I need 15 minutes, I need 20 minutes, I need an hour. And then an hour becomes 2 hours and becomes a little longer until you check back in with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But to travel 7 rivers, how long must it have taken him? How long must it have taken him to travel the 7 rivers? And he still, nothing shattered his stupor.
He was still hypnotized. He was still chasing the Zona. Seven rivers, my goodness. Think about what that means. Sometimes we just run. Sometimes it's there. We sit down. We're in a situation, a social situation, personal situation. We fall into a bad moment and we feel regretting. It's a regrettable decision. But sometimes we really just run. Nothing stops us. We pass through seven rivers and nothing douses. We need it so badly. Nothing stops us or blunts or thwarts it. I pass through seven rivers. Now he sits with her. And Bishas Hergil, line number three, and for the sake of clarity, I'll say something. As they are physically engaged, so now it's the moment. Bishas Hergil Davar Heficha. Unbelievable. She lets gas out. She has to relieve herself from some bodily gas. Amra, she tells him, Kishem Shafichazu Eina Chazeres Limkoma. Just like the gas that came out of my body can't be retrieved. Kach Elezer ben Dordaya, Ein Mekabli Moso B'tshuva. You're also irretrievable. You're also unredeemable, just like the gas that left my body. And somehow, all those years of hypnosis and denial fade away. No one could get to him. Not his parents, not his friends, not whatever moral authorities were in his life. He had built these walls of self-defense that were impregnable. But you know what got to him? He was able to see the F word. He was able to see fantasy for what it was. Because fantasy dresses reality in glitter and shiny, disproportionate shells. And it makes us look at things completely, completely unrealistically. I promise you that if all the celebrities that catch your attention, whether they're athletes or celebrities that people like looking at because of their body or their body shape or the way their nose is shaped or whatever, I promise you if they came into this room dressed as you are, there would be at least the 20th most attractive person in this room. Not the most attractive person. You're not seeing real people. You're seeing dressed up mannequins, photoshops, glitter, contexts, hype, Hollywood, euphoria, movies. They're normal people like you and me. And when you see them on planes, on public spaces, without their makeup on, without the hype surrounding them, out of context, they're just normal people. They're pretty short. They're pretty unremarkable. They're pretty unimpressive. And you know what? Just like this Zona, they go to the bathroom and their bodies rot and their bodies let out gas. And their bodies decompose and their bodies become brittle. But we get lost in that world of fantasy. And all of a sudden we see things through the lenses of complete distorted reality. It's called a fantasy lens. If you just, you know, on your phone, you take a picture with different lenses and it recolors the images. It's called a fantasy lens. It so often leads us to engage ourselves. Same thing with athletes. All these athletes, it's just they'd be normal people. They'd be a little taller. Their muscles would probably be bigger. But if you sat across the table with them and you just stripped away all the cultural context within which they live, they'd be pretty boring people, pretty average people. It's really not as remarkable as the people in this room or the types of people you're becoming. And in that moment, he just saw for what she was. She went through the same biological processes as he did. She had to digest her food like he did. And all of a sudden, the veneer came falling down. The facade came tumbling down. This is not the Zona from overseas, the international Zona that everyone talks about that charges a sack of gold. This is a human being like you and me. It's a regular human being. Try to repeat that mantra to yourselves a lot in life. It'll get you far. They're just regular human beings on many fronts. Don't be intimidated by people's wealth. Don't be intimidated by their power. And certainly, don't be enthralled by their, so to speak, celebrity status. We've created the celebrity of nothing. It used to be celebrities were people of accomplishment. And you could claim that maybe their celebrity status was disproportionate to their accomplishment. Maybe we shouldn't be so reverential to Albert Einstein or to Thomas Edison or to people of real accomplishment. Or maybe we should. But today we've created celebrity of ghosts, people of no substance to them. They haven't accomplished anything of importance. They're celebrities because they've I don't know, they've grabbed airtime, they've grabbed internet interest, they've flashed more parts of their bodies, have got X million followers, or they're more provocative, or whatever. And because of the millions of people that follow them, they create celebrity status. And all of a sudden, you become tyrannized by this emotional bondage. You find yourself drawn to caring about their lives and following their activities. And it's not bittul Torah. It's just, it's a waste of resources, a waste of interest. Why should you be engaged in the lives of these people? Why should their lives matter to you? Why should you be following so interested in them? So all of a sudden, it all comes shattering. It all shatters. It all smashes. Halach v'yashav bein shnei harim v'gvos. Line number 5. So Lezer ben Derdaya goes and sits between two mountains. Incredible, incredible conversation here. He turns to the mountains. Amar, line number 5. Harim u'gvos. Bakshu alai rachamim. Always waiting for other people to take care of you. Other people to step in for you. Other people to lead you. Other people. You guys are now at the transition point. No one's gonna perform tshuva for you. Hopefully the mountains, nature. Amru lo, line number 6. The mountains say, Ad she'anu mevakshim alecha. You're asking us to daven for you. Nevakish al atzmeinu. We're too busy with the nevuah and Yeshaya. The nevuah and Yeshaya says, Ki harim yamushu vagvos timutenu. Shem says, in the achris hayamim, the mountains will be pulverized. So we've got enough on our plate. He turns to the moon and the sun, and he asks them for rachamim. I'm paraphrasing. We don't have to read every line. The moon and the sun says, you're asking us for rachamim. Have you read the apocalyptic nevuos? One day when the apocalypse happens, there'll be eclipses, and the sun will be torn out of its orbit. We're too busy worrying about ourselves. And then he turns to the kochavim and the mazalos, to the stars in the sky, and he says, maybe you guys can help. And they say, we're busy also, without getting into the details of why the sun and the moon, the stars and the mountains are busy. What is Elazar ben Derdaya looking to mountains and stars and suns? Why all of a sudden are these? Why doesn't he go to his Rebbe? Why doesn't he go to a local person to help in daven? He turns to mountains, inanimate objects. Sometimes the world feels very fixed. Sometimes you feel that you live in a predetermined world. I think, this is my just hunch, I feel that you guys feel that more heavily than we did when I was your age. I felt like we lived in a world of opportunity and a world of that was dynamic and a world that was changing and a world that could be shaped. I think you feel smaller to your world. Not smaller for accomplishments that can be measured by metrics, tests and scores and money and careers. I think you feel a lot of upward mobility. What about changing the world? What about really creating a different reality, not just getting a better job, but what about really making an imprint on this world and being part of an overhaul and a change and pioneering something of lasting import? I'm not in any way diminishing the importance of professions and salaries and raises, but anything that will outlast you. Or making a contribution that will have impact 200 years after you leave the earth, and clearly all the other aspects are no longer relevant. How about making yourself not a footnote to history, but an author of history, and really making a change of lasting? I was actually thinking about that on the way. I was thinking about it today, a few moments ago, I'm learning with Cook's Sarah Satchuva. And I was asking myself, I've got such an allergy to politics. I don't really care about politics. And I was just thinking in objective metric terms, what has greater influence, politicians or people that live deeply moral lives? So the politicians grab headlines, in the immediate sense, they impact the lives of millions, but then they come and go. It's hard to trace our lives to the decision of some politician from 1850. It's part of a larger mousetrap and a larger calculus that got offset by opposing forces. And just there are a lot of Americans in the room. This is not a political statement, but think about all the efforts that Obama took and how many of those efforts are being offset or in some ways suppressed by Trump's policies. So I'm not supporting one or the other. Politics comes and goes. But if you lead a moral life and you create values that are deeply held by people and then passed on to other people and that shape lives and shape families and are passed on and aren't upset and they become augmented and developed, and you're making real irreversible change in people's lives. So I'm not in any way advising you what you should do, but just be able to take a few steps back and put things into proportion. So he's looking to the mountains and says, can the world really change? This is a world of change. Maybe the world is fixed, and maybe I'm a sinner, and maybe I'm doomed, and maybe I'm condemned, and maybe the zone is correct, and maybe I'm irretrievable, and maybe I'm like the mountains, and the mountains tell them, no, we're also, you think we're fixed? We also are unstable. We also have to worry about our future. We also have prophecies about
how our orbits can change and our zodiacs can be altered and the heavens and the oceans can be reshaped. And don't think you live in such a fixed world. I lived enough in my life to see ideas and institutions and organizations that we thought were fixed and people that just couldn't be altered. And it passed like a dream. Kachalom ya'ov, kitzitz novel, kachasir yavej. I mean, I lived when I was your age in abject fear of the Soviet Union. Everyone was afraid of the Soviet Union and they controlled a third of the earth. And all of a sudden it just disappeared. It just withered in front of our eyes. Human conventions come and go. And this is a world of change. And that's what he heard. And all of a sudden it clicked. He says, Eina davar tali ela bi. I can't rely on mountains. I can't rely on stars. Eina davar tali ela bi. And also, he was doubting whether he could perform tshuva, because when you feel that low, and he felt low, and you'll see how low he felt in a moment, maybe you disqualify yourself. Maybe I'm just too impure. Maybe I'm too treif. Maybe I'm too disgusting. Maybe I'm a failure, right? Maybe it's just this great catharsis in releasing yourself from responsibility and defining yourself as a failure and as an unredeemed and as Elisha ben Avuya. It's a great release because then you've acquitted yourself from effort. Well, nothing I'll do will have any impact, so why should I try? I'm already in that dead zone. I've already given up. Remember Yonah goes down to sleep? There's a vicious gale storm. Everyone's davening. Everyone's trying to lighten the load. He goes to take a nap. He basically has given up. Malach HaNirdam, what are you sleeping? I think I quote it in Pesukim of Yonah. No, I quote some other Pesukim of Yonah. But it's a classic form of Yeish, the classic form of giving up. There's great release in giving up. But Elazar ben Dardai doesn't give up. And not only does he not give up, but he says, well, that's who does tshuva, if not for terrible people. That's who tshuva is for. People that committed terrible crimes, people that are monsters, people that look in the mirror and see themselves, and that's what Hashem wants. It's exactly what Hashem wants in advice for tshuva. Amar ein hadavar tali ela bi, third to last line. I've got to take it on my own shoulders. Another great mantra to remember, not just for tshuva. It's a transition moment, guys. Talk about transitions. Ein hadavar tali ela bi. It's now on you. This is your life. No one is going to steward your life anymore. No one's going to make decisions for you as they did in high school. From here on in, the shape of your life, and as I said last week, the shape of your eternity, not just the shape of your life, will end at some point. Your eternity won't. You'll live beyond this world. So the shape of your identity, which is endless, is the decisions you make. Every day, again, don't become neurotic. Some decisions are great. Some decisions you fail at. But look at the overall body of work of your decisions. You're shaping your future. There's no future. There's no predetermined future. Hiniach Rosho, second to last line of the Gemara, Daf Yud Zayin and Avodah Zarah. Hiniach Rosho Bein Birkav. He put his head between his knees. He couldn't even hold his head up anymore. Remember David HaMelech? Remember Daniel? Remember Ezra? They can't lift their head anymore. Sometimes you don't want to lift your head. I know sometimes when I go under the talus because I want privacy for Al-Khayt, sometimes I go on the talus because I don't feel like I want Hashem to look at me. I don't feel like I want to be seen. Like an old baby's trick. If you put your hand over your eyes, maybe Hashem won't look at you. Because if he looks, he'll see. And if he sees, he'll see certain things that I lie to myself about, but Hashem doesn't lie to himself about it. So he puts his head between his knees. V'ga b'b'chi, and he starts crying. Starts crying. That's really what tshuva is. It's one tear. All it needs is one tear. It doesn't take a long time. But the tear has to come from a very deep place of authenticity. And that takes a long time to reach authenticity. It's a lot of excavation, a lot of self-discovery. I'm sure a lot of you had it over Rosh Hashanah. You found yourselves being a whole new person. You discovered parts of yourself that you didn't know before existed. Truths about yourself that you either didn't know or like to avoid. That's what makes it such a fantastic time of year. It's incredulous to me that just because you're the oldest boy in the room, Tal Ursler on Aleph Cheshvan will be the same Tal Ursler on Aleph Tishrei. Of course he won't be. You'll go through such a metamorphosis. You'll find out who you are and you'll discover parts of yourself and you'll try to make some change, whatever changes you can make and other changes you won't make. But that's, I'm expecting a different Moshe Tarragon to show up in 3 weeks. I can honestly tell you, I'm not going to, it's very private, I can honestly tell you that already I discovered parts about myself that I wasn't fully aware of. I've got to really work hard at changing. And I'm an old person, and trying to scrape away more. What are the things I don't visit? What are the areas I cover and I don't try to understand deeply because they're painful or because I need them for coping? How can I become a truer person? How can I be more of a ish emes, of a Kadosh Baruch Hu's emes, and I'm living with Hashem? So he sits there and he cries. And he dies. Could you imagine being so full of grief that you die of a broken heart? Just like you have to be Moser Nefesh for Abbas Hashem. Rabbi Kiva Darshan from the Pasuk, Be'avdas Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha b'chol nafshecha, afil hu notel as nafshecha, that you have to love Hashem to the point of death. Can you love tshuva that much? Can you bring yourself to the point where if you had two choices and the cost for tshuva were death, which would you choose? It's a total hypothetical question because the purpose of tshuva is to lead to life. But let's say you had that choice. Break it down. You're mature now. And you know that the price of really finding tshuva and finding a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that meant all of eternity being on the Kadosh Baruch Hu were death. Now, it's obviously it's an emotional moment. You're not making a choice. Like Kiddush Hashem, where someone puts a gun to your head, you make a choice. But that means there's no holds barred. Nothing. He's not holding anything back. He's full of grief, and he's letting it cascade throughout every nook and cranny of his neshama. At a certain point, he becomes so suffused with grief and sadness that he doesn't hold back. He doesn't try to stop it. He lets it flow, and it flows, and it flows, and it flows, and all the memories of all the zonos, and all the wasted years, and all the self-humiliation just suffuse him, and his heart can't take it. His emotional subsystem just disintegrates, and he dies. It goes crazy. And the Baskol comes out and says, Yatsa Baskol v'amra, Releza ben Derdaya mizuman, l'chay olam haba. I always wondered why he's called Rebbe Eliezer ben Derdaya. He was such a sinner. They're different Gersels. I think in the Yishalmi he's not called Rebbe, but in the Bavli he's called Rebbe. At that point he becomes, you know, what do they call it? Posthumously, they give him an award. They give him an honorary Rebbe degree because he was a Rebbe of Tshuva. And his story teaches us the places we want to try to visit. I don't know that any of us can identify with his life of squalor and futility. We're not as addicted as he was, but maybe in other ways there's addictions and addicted to certain needs, addicted to certain need for comfort and security, and how can we let that go and get to some better place and leap beyond self-imposed or socially imposed limits of mediocrity. That's the drama of the next couple of weeks, next 2 weeks, next week or so. Everyone here is serious-minded, but will it be quiet or will it be riotous? Will it be light or will it be gloomy? Will it be relaxed or will it be full of grief? Will it be regret or will it be sadness, pain, frustration, humiliation? Pick your emotion or a combination of those. But whenever you reach that low point, don't pass that boundary. That's the moment and that's the place of tshuva. Yonah passed the boundary and he just gave up, and Hashem had to revive him. And the only way he could revive him was to toss him into the sea and be swallowed by a fish. And that was a revival. It's a whole different shir, not for now. The revival of Yonah in the belly of the fish. Eliezer ben Derdaya almost reaches that point, but he pulls himself up. Elisha ben Avuya pretty much passed the boundary. The Gemara in Chagiga says that a Baskol came out one day and said, everyone can perform tshuva, except for Elisha ben Avuya. But that wasn't the Baskol. The Baskol was, everyone can perform tshuva, except he filled in the blanks, Elisha ben Avuya. The Baskol can never say that everyone can perform tshuva, except. Such a Baskol doesn't exist. His mind was playing tricks on him. He was looking to project that excuse to acquit himself, to release himself. Well, I'm condemned, and therefore I can live the rest of my life in freedom and hedonism, whatever I choose, agnosticism. Okay, I miscalculated. I'm thinking 7:15, but we have until 7:03 or 4. But let me give you some tips and hints for Yom Kippur. The real goal of Yom Kippur, of course, let me see if I have it here. Some Yoma. I hope I quoted it for you. I'm Rabbi Akiva, part 4, Zion. Ashrechem Yisrael, Lethei Miatem, Netaharim. Hashem pours water on you, and then Rabbi Akiva becomes more audacious. The bottom of the second page, front side. Mikveh Yisrael Hashem, a pasuk in Yirmiyah, which literally means Hashem is the hope of the Jewish people, but Rabbi Akiva interprets it, Mikveh Yisrael Hashem is the mikvah. Ma mikvah mitaris atmeim, af HaKadosh Baruch Hu mitaris Yisrael. I'm going to hand out to the boys on my shiur, and I'll also post it on my Facebook. Rav Lichtenstein would write an email, write a poster. You hang up every year in Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur in the yeshiva. And he and people like him and of his madrega would refer to Yom Kippur as Yom HaGadol V'Hanara. Yom Kippur is the day of legal absolution and penitence. Yom HaGadol V'Hanara is the great day of being with Hashem. This is the day that's closest to your future. This is the day where you won't be eating. This is the day you won't be drinking. But don't get lost in the tzel. That's just the springboard. That's just helping you leap to an Olam Haba-like world in which it's just you and Hashem, and you're in the mikveh of Hashem. That's what it'll be like in 120 years, when you don't have hair, heads, clothes, food, money, feet, tables, nothing. It's be you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. You won't need to eat. You won't need to drink, obviously. It's different. It'll be less challenging than Yom Kippur. But the challenge of Yom Kippur is made in Olam Haba. Get to that world that's the closest resemblance of what your world will be like forever and ever and ever. And it's just this little parenthesis called life on this planet. Forever and ever. So here's your opportunity to try to make the transition I spoke about before. To me, the greatest barometer of religious maturity is when one day goes from being your worst day to being your best day. Let's face it. What's your worst day when you're a teenager? The day you least like. It's Yom Kippur. It's long. You fast. It's hot. You daven all day. And what's your favorite day? Matzah Yom Kippur. You got a, come on guys, don't deny it. You got a whole year until you have to go through that again. And then Purim comes, and you get a little antsy because you know you're 7 months away, and Pesach, and now you know you're six away, and you know, Tisha B'Av, it's 10th of Av, and 2 months away, and Elul, and the Shofar, and no, oh, and it's here, okay. Oh, okay, I did it. Go back to life. Now it's Yud Aleph Tishrei, I got 358 days until I've got to do that again. And then something that incredible happens. I promise you. Maybe it'll happen this year. Maybe you'll start to appreciate that it can happen. Yom Kippur becomes your favorite day. And you can't wait for it. I'm flying. I'm riding the clouds this week. I can't wait. A whole day that I can live like the eternal me, not the grounded me. A whole day that I don't even have to worry about food or drink or my body. I just, my neshama can soar to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I promise you, my saddest day of the year is Matzah Yom Kippur. I feel like I'm being thrown out of Shemayim, whatever level I was able to reach, because I still have to be in this world, and I have to deal with this world, and I'll do my best, but I know that the world will ravage me, and the world will compromise me, and the world will infiltrate me, but that's Hashem's will. I'm still in this world, and I'll do my best. That's the real catch of Yom Kippur. Can you see beyond the fast? Can you get beyond the fast? Can you get to the Mikveh Yisrael? Can you get to be with Hashem in Shemayim? And then once you do that, then I promise you it will be your favorite day of the year. To be with Hashem a whole day, not to have to worry about anything. How do you do it? Three or four tips. Practical tips. Follow one of them. I promise you you'll be able to follow all of them. You're giving yourself your best shot. The most powerful one, and I do it every year. Walk into the Beis Medrash. And take off your handcuffs. My handcuffs, I don't have handcuffs on. Well, you're taking off your handcuff of food. You're not eating. Your handcuff of drink. You're not drinking. But there's another handcuff. It's called time. You're living in time. You don't know how much time tyrannizes you. Even without alarms, even without, seriously, without Avi having his alarm go off, in the back of your mind now, seriously, listen to me. I want to, this is an important mental experiment. You know in about 10 minutes this year will end. So you're leveraging the termination of this year, and it's diluting the impact of this year. You're listening, you're not listening, but you know it's going to end, right? Come on. It's going to end in 10 minutes. We'll all go back to being us. We'll all daven. We'll all eat dinner. And we'll... At every step, you know that the... When you know that pain's about to end, then pain ends even before it ends. Because pain is compounded by the expectation of pain and hurt. So if you know that it's going to take away, like, you know, pins and needles, when you know that pins and needles are going to go away, so it doesn't really hurt you, or the shot, right? You know the shot's going to be a second, like a little pinch, it doesn't really... Scary, because you see it, but if you take away the psychology, it's a little prick, it's a little... As opposed to a duration. So the way we live in time very much shapes our experience. And it curtails the impact of whatever experience we're going through. You know it's going to end. How often on Yom Kippur do you spend looking at your watch and say, okay, I already fasted 7 hours, I have 17 more. I already fasted 2/3, I have a third, not you, me, third more. I already fasted out, so I'm at 67%, I still have 23% or 33%, you're always factoring. You're basically leveraging the completion and the termination of the day to weaken its impact while it's happening, because you're giving yourself a mental escape route, psychological escape, now it's going to end. What if you took your watch off and you put it on the side and you just don't know what time it is whatsoever? You may reach the point where you tell yourself, I wish this could go on forever. I wish I didn't have to end it because my body's calling me back to this earth, but I'm living far beyond any human limitations. I'm not eating, I'm not drinking. And I don't even care what time it is. I don't care. As far as I'm concerned, if I could take the pill or press the lever, this day would go on forever. Okay, I'm still in a body. I'm still shackled to this body. This body has to eat, and this body has to drink, and this body has to go to sleep and live in time. Take your watch off. Try it at night. Don't know what time it is. Don't see when is it going to end. If it does well for you at night, try it in the day. I can only tell you, again, this is just, with all humility, thousands of people have tried this and told me that it worked for them. Just take off your watch throughout the years. I told you before, the Yetzer Hara has a certain plan for you on Yom Kippur. And his plan is not to try to keep you out of the base medrash, because that's not going to work too well. Yetzer Hara, he's pretty skilled. He's been around for a while. But you know how he's going to come dressed up for the Yetzer Hara? Yom Kippur is Purim. You know how he comes dressed up on Yom Kippur? You know what his Purim costume is? It's called Thursday. He's going to flood your mind with what you're doing on Thursday. The tiulim, the friends, the pizza, the family, the lulav and esrog shopping. Because that's another way to have you escape the ferocity and the intensity of the day. He wants you to plan, because then you're telling yourself, well, come on, this will end. We'll walk out. The buses will be running. The movies will be showing. The sports team will have played their games. And this will all just be some fantasy 24 hours that I can neatly package and put somewhere else rather than... Because if you're really serious, aren't you really davening for the world to end Wednesday? Isn't that what we'd like? If you're really serious, really honestly ask yourself, wouldn't you like the world to end Wednesday? And every plan you have for post-Wednesday be rendered irrelevant. And I'll say that two ways. Either because we'll daven so hard, and so many Jews will daven so hard, that Wednesday night, all of a sudden, we'll find ourselves beamed into the Kotel, watching Mashiach. Or maybe you get to the part of davening where all you want is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And you tell Hashem, you know what? I want you so badly, or I want to want you so badly, that where I am with you is not so important anymore. Whether it's here or in Shemayim, I just want to be with you. If you really reduce it, that's where your tefillah has to be, right? Otherwise, it's oligocentric. And the only reason I want to be here is because I have responsibilities and family and opportunity and potential. But if you just reduced it all, just you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, would it make a difference where you were? Shouldn't. And if it does, then it's no longer about you and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's about you and you. You and your egocentric needs. Now, it just so happens you're all young, but you all have a lot of potential, and Ritzo Shem Hashem put you here for long lives of productivity and contribution and learning and growing, and therefore can't end. It shouldn't end. Bezus Hashem. It won't end. Bezus Hashem is Baruch. But that's Hashem's decision, isn't it? It shouldn't make a difference to you as long as you have Hashem. As long as we're in the Mikveh Yisrael. So the second that Thursday comes into your mind, kick it out. Banish it. It's hard. You'll see yourself thinking a lot about Thursday, the Tiol. This is not Tiol, but friends, and where you going to go, where you going to eat, where you going to sleep, and where you going to... Can you fake yourself out? Can you say, as far as I'm concerned, I am happy with locking in Yom Kippur forever. And it shouldn't be a Thursday. That's unrealistic because we don't live in that world. But as far as I'm concerned, history can end tomorrow and I'd be happy. And everything I've planned is just a bit of it. If it happens, I'll live it. I'll deal with it. They're tricks. They sound like tricks. We hope, but these tricks help you get down to real honest tefillah. Are you still being dishonest in your tefillah? Say, I'm davening, but I really can't wait for the tannis to end, me to eat, go back, carry on my life, watch sports, and... I said, what was it? It was a try my best, but I was deluding on Kodesh Baruch Hu. In the end of the day, are you honest with yourself? If you really want to be with Hashem, then everything else is. So number one, take your watch off. Number two, the second that word Thursday or Shabbos, because it's so close to Shabbos, comes into your mind, forget it. I don't care. If I'm successful, the world as I know it will cease to exist tomorrow. Whether collectively and historically or... I'm davening to change my reality. I'm davening right now that everything I came into Yom Kippur with will be gone. And it will be perfected and improved. And I'll have to adapt to a new reality. I don't know what that is. I trust it'll be better and I'll join it. I'm all in. Can you make your davening about HaKadosh Baruch Hu? And say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it's really about you. I say, L'mancham, lo l'manenu. I need to live because I really believe, like when I leave this world, it will be a better place because I've lived there. I will raise a family, the Yerushalayim and Avodas Hashem. I will learn your will. I will try to role model it for people. I will somehow be part of returning to Eretz Yisrael. All of the above, one of the above, whatever. But I will make it. I'm here for you. And therefore, you have to send me down because you need people on this earth. Without me being here, your world is going to be less developed. And I need to be in this world for you. I'd rather be with you, but you can't always get what you want. I have to be in this world far from you in order to help this world recognize you. And here's the last bit of advice, and this is taken straight out of Rav Lichtenstein's playbook. I'll circulate the letter. I remember when I came back to Yeshiva University for college, I was in Yeshiva University 1 year for Yom Kippur, or several years, but 1 year I was there for Yom Kippur. I walked out of Musaf, and I turned to a friend of mine who wasn't a big, Rosh Yeshiva, it was a guy my age, and I remember his name, everybody looked like. And I said, how was your davening? I said, nice small talk with him. He went like this to me. I said, well, how was your davening? He went like this. I turned to the third guy. I said, why is he talking to me? So he said, he made a tannis dibur. You know, some people make a tannis dibur in Yom Kippur, not to talk at all except for davening. And I looked at this guy like he was from Mars. Tannis dibur, what do you mean? Come on. A couple years later, I think it was my second year of making Aliyah, I was at a crossroads, that certain things I had to think about. I said, I'm going to make a tannis dibur. I told the people in my vicinity, my parents and my brother, and you know, I told them I didn't want to be rude to people. You know, all of a sudden spring on people, you're living with other people. The purpose of this story is not to encourage you to make a tannis dibur. I don't think any of you should be making a tannis dibur right now. If you really feel you should, then speak to either an older boy or a Rebbe. Make sure you're doing it for sincere, substantive reasons, not just for shtick and gimmick. Right now, I think there are other ways for you to grow. It's not tannis dibur. Talk if you need to. But socializing and chit-chat in shul, especially outside of shul, it's just, you're losing it. Then it's just the day to make off like a bandit with your penitence rather than to be with Hashem. Rav Lichtenstein, I'll show you the letter. The guy's in my share, and obviously it'll be on my Facebook page on Tuesday. I put it out for all the alumni and others who want to follow. I have an English translation that I wrote because a lot of people don't understand his Hebrew. This letter was the harshest letter Aaron ever wrote. He said, it's absolutely usser in the campus of Yeshiva to be involved in any socializing during the breaks, not that it's such long breaks. Remember, this is a throwback to a while ago when a lot of girls would come to yeshiva because there weren't places adequate for girls in the seminary year to daven. But there'll still be girls here that you know, maybe Megan or everyone's davening, I'm not in charge, but you don't want to be rude to anyone. Chas v'shalom, you say, k'sif chasim tova. But the sense you're going to carry out, and not just with girls, any socializing that's lightheaded,
any socializing that's just to shoot the breeze, to talk about nothing. And certainly when you're with girls, you know that your tone changes. You want to say things that impress them. You want them to look at you in a way where you talk to me. I mean, Rebbe, you talk to your friend. You don't care who sees your hair, your clothing, whatever. You talk to a girl. Because obviously, you're in a different phase. You're in a different frequency. And they're healthy during the rest of it. There's nothing wrong with them. In the rest of the year, all these conversations are healthy and appropriate as long as they adhere to certain parameters. When you're kippur. And of course, I'm concerned and I'm urging you, not just for this year, but to train yourself. In Yom Kippur, you do two things. You sleep and you daven. And you walk to different places. Now, in the interim, you're living in a world. Good morning, how's your fast, whatever, but really, really minimal. Or you talk about Yom Kippur issues. Tova lichtensi, in her prime, used to be the policeman. Policewoman. She would literally stand outside the Beis Medrash. Images burnt into my memory. And physically, but almost physically, push boys out of the mevoah. They were just hanging around talking and schmoozing. I remember, you can ask her, it's like you're going to ask her, but she would literally heave people away. There's nothing wrong. Hanging out, it's good, good job. People, there's some. Hopefully some of you this year will grow into be better at your social skills, talking, enjoying each other, good humor, good talk. And that's a very important skill as part of your avodas Hashem, for sure. Nan Yom Kippur. Mikvei Yisrael Hashem. Can you walk up that mountain? Can you just be 24 hours with the Kodesh Baruch Hu? Those are four things to think about. The watch, no Thursday, Wednesday. Make it about a Kodesh Baruch Hu, not about you and your needs. And finally, can you create the bubble of silence. Bubble of silence doesn't mean you don't say anything. But you feel like your whole day is just living with Hashem. And if you do that, I promise you, and now I think I have a little more credit because of the Rosh Hashanah, right? All of a sudden, hey, who wants to do Rosh Hashanah again? I don't know that everyone would say no. Maybe we needed 2-3 days to recuperate. It was pretty cool to really want more davening and want to sing more and want to be with everyone. It was a cool experience. Can you have that for Yom Kippur? Can it become your favorite day of the year, or can you be on that route to have it become your favorite day of the year? In many ways, if it is, then I think you could be very proud of yourself religiously. If Yom Kippur is really your favorite day, it pretty much shows that you're in religion for the right reasons. If you basically, religion is your second back burner thing, so you'd rather not go through, maybe you want to see, you get the get out of jail free card, you get the penitence, but it's tough, but you got to pay the price, you know, it's a, what about if you're just doing it because you really enjoy religion, you really want to be from, you really... Then, of course, what's the pinnacle of your frumkeit? The day that you're with Hashem and the day that you're working for when this world ends. And why would you not want that day to last forever? But it can, because we all have these things called bodies. Okay, guys, hatzlacha with the rest of the week. And mitzvah Hashem. Boys in my share will elaborate on this mitzvah Hashem over the next couple of weeks. Myra's in 2 minutes, so...